Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated weekly design show. I'm your host, Henry Rees-Sheridan. On today's show, we set sail for the glamorous side of Biscayne Bay for a roundup of the best of this year's Design Miami show.
There's an incredible Puvet President's Desk. There's wonderful Maria Perguet pieces. Mark Benda brought a new group of work from Misha Khan that I think is incredible. There's so many nice moments throughout the fair.
Rodman Premack there, Chief Creative Officer of Design Miami, the global design show that ran alongside Art Basel Miami. Monocle's Megan Billings was out there. She gave us her take on the show and a few choice interviews with the galleries worth watching. Plus,
what print magazines are doing very well is providing a sort of counterbalance to the sort of superficial level at which a lot of online content deals with design.
A treat for print fans, design journalist and Fiera editor Katie Tregeddon joins us for a leaf through some of the best design magazines on newsstands today. That's all coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. In a calendar saturated with stuffy halls and sad sandwiches, Design Miami, the offshoot of the Art Basel Fair in Miami each December, is a sunny and salubrious affair. Private collectors and privileged onlookers numbering some 40,000 vie for one-off pieces and immerse themselves in design-minded installations by over 30 galleries displaying their wares from a rather pretty perch in Miami Beach. Aside from the fun, festivities, and plentiful parties to pass the time, the event is something of a bellwether for the design industry as a whole. Monocle's New York-based Deputy Bureau Chief Megan Billings jetted down to the Sunshine State to take the temperature of proceedings. She sat down with Josh Fennett to tell him all about it.
Design Miami, that famous sister show to Art Basel Miami, in a much nicer location, I might add. You've been out there. What have you seen? What are the main headlines, the take-homes from your trip over Biscayne Bay?
Well, it was really nice to be in the tropics, I have to admit. You know, one thing that was really nice about the show this year was that they actually redesigned the layout of the fair. So it felt a lot more spacious and very manageable. I mean, it's usually quite manageable because it's a smaller fair, but, you know, the layout was just really user-friendly. And then right in the centerpiece was this new Dean and DeLuca rollout of kind of a beautiful lunch counter.
And tell me, Megan, I mean, you know, Miami has various very positive and kind of louche associations. And if you were perusing the stats from this year's fair, there's a record number of visitors, almost 38,000. There's 31 galleries exhibiting, five of which are new. Was there a positive feel? Or, as in other things that we've covered in Monocle, is there a sense that the luxury market is taking a little bit of a time to kind of recover? And you can feel free to challenge me on whether you think this is a luxury market, but Design Miami, was there a positive feel? Do you think people were spending money?
I do think that they were. I would say it felt a little quiet, but I was there still during preview time. But when I had already arrived, for example, one of the galleries I visited, Friedman Benda, they were showing Misha Khan, who's a really young designer, and all of his stuff had sold out already in the first day. And, you know, this is a collectible market, so it's really high design and obviously an extremely high price point. So I think the people who are purchasing these kind of items are a very specific kind of collector.
And being an excellent journalist with a nose for a good story, you headed straight to the source of inspiration, I believe, for the first interview of the few that you've prepared for us. Who did you meet?
I first met with Rodman Premack, who is the creative director of Design Miami. As I said, first and foremost, he redesigned kind of the layout of the show to make it very open, and it just was a really nice feeling for the show. And he has an incredible job because Art Basel is quite huge. And Design Miami, as you said, there's a lot fewer people showing there. So he has to really sift through a lot and make the show great and kind of just pick out the best of the best.
And here is your interview now with Rodman Premack, the creative director of Design Miami.
Tell me, because I just got here, I just got off a plane, what are some of the highlights of the show this year for you?
There's so many ways to approach that question. There's the highlights that are within the gallery program, like this fantastic Jean Lursat tapestry hanging at Francoise Gallery downtown. That's from 1965. It's like the biggest tapestry ever made. It's really beautiful. There's an incredible Puvet President's Desk at Patrick Seguin from, I think, circa 1958 that has just an amazing provenance. There's wonderful Maria Perguet pieces. I love, in the contemporary things, Mark Benda brought a new group of work from Misha Khan that I think is incredible. These light pieces that you should really make sure that you see. There's so many nice moments throughout the fair. From the jewelry side, Louisa Guinness has done such a fantastic installation that it's really worth seeing. Jason Jacques, who's one of our favorite voices in ceramics, worked with Digifab Studio to create this incredible environment for contemporary ceramics that are really great. And there's a lot of really nice things throughout the fair.
One thing I love about coming to Design Miami is the size and the scale of it. It's so much more manageable than going to Art Basel, which is kind of colossal. And so I imagine that for you, that means a bit of a tough job of kind of outfitting what's happening here. So how many submissions do you have to go through? How do you get it to this level?
There's a couple different things to think about. One, I think that the fair reflects very well in terms of its scale. The scale of our actual market. The collectible design market is not a huge market. The contemporary art market is enormous at this stage. Collectible design is still growing and getting momentum, and every year feels bigger in terms of the amount of collectors there are, but that's not matched by the amount of galleries there are. At the same time, we get at least double, sometimes even triple, the amount of applications for Design Miami, then we have space for them. And in Miami, we are confined by our location, which is on a parking lot across from the convention center of Art Basel. So we only have so much space here. Interestingly, this year, we redesigned the fair entirely, the layout of the fair and many aspects of the fair. But the square footage is basically the same, but we edited out some galleries just due to the new architecture, not because we didn't like the galleries, but we just could only accommodate so many galleries, and we have fewer galleries, and many people think that the show is bigger and think that there are more galleries and more diversity. So it's like an interesting thing to think about how changing the architecture and the way that people are experiencing something changes their perception of something they've experienced a number of times before.
I just want to shift focus a little bit to this Dean and DeLuca kiosk, I guess you could call it, which is behind us. It's a bit more than that. Dean and DeLuca is very well established in New York, and they're kind of launching this concept here, and it's beautiful and beautifully designed, and I just wonder what that says about brand Design Miami.
I take very seriously the brand Design Miami and the experience that people have at the fair. As you were saying earlier, we're such a smaller fair than Art Basel. Because of our smallness, I approach it like a smaller hotel in the sense that we have a little bit more time, I think, and more invested in thinking through details, certain kinds of details, and the way that people are experiencing the fair. Design is in everything we do. So if we were to present a design fair that was like ugly and not thought about, it would not make sense for a design fair. So we really do think about lots of different aspects of the experience, both visual and sort of physical. The food element has always been something that we've been interested in. In years previous, we worked with like Michael Schwartz from Michael's Genuine, who's one of the best chefs in Miami. And because we're not in the convention center, we are lucky to not have to work with union labor. There's nothing wrong with union labor, but in the food service industry, it seems to allow us to have better food. And we also think that there's a real relationship between architecture, design, and food. Particularly now, people love restaurant culture and love food culture. It connects with sustainability and like all of the things that are interesting to us and interesting to designers. So when we started speaking to Dean and DeLuca over a year ago about this project, they were already working on this new concept with Ola Sharon, and we were super excited that they wanted to debut it at Design Miami. We've given it a lot of space because it's become kind of like the public plaza of the fair. And for our galleries, you know, they can't really leave all day long. We're sort of, my team and the galleries, we're sort of trapped here for like a 12-hour stretch. And being able to eat really well, I think, has made everybody feel so well taken care of and in a good mood. And I'm sure it's resulting in more sales. Or at least I want to tell myself that.
And that was Rodman Primack there, the creative director of Design Miami, speaking to our very own Megan Billings. And I'm delighted to say that Megan is still here with us. Plenty more to talk about at the show. And as I look through the running order, you know, I've always thought of Miami as being an interesting kind of jumping-off point for South America as well as the US market. But it would appear that there have been fewer surprises, or maybe a smaller emphasis, would it be fair to say, on the South American markets? Or is it just that these pieces aren't selling? We've got a couple more US examples coming up later on in the show. But before that, we're going to head to Milan.
Yes. So Fendi actually commissioned an Italian designer who's quite young named Cristina Celestino to design a VIP room for their stores. This was my absolute favorite thing at Design Miami. She really kind of took something very classic and put little touches that were really out of the bounds. Like, she put fur on the bottom of a sofa. She put fur and resin around a mirror. She took the design of earring backs to make the base of tables. And it was really unexpected and beautiful and just really well done. And what's interesting about it is that nothing of that was for sale because it was just for Fendi's VIP rooms. But while I was there and throughout the day, everyone was coming up and asking when and how they could purchase these items.
So that's actually the ultimate victory, isn't it? And I've seen images. They're these kind of candy-coloured, pastely pinks and golds and marbles with interspersed with a kind of little bit of wood too. I'm going to push you here for a controversial answer. But do you think it's important at Design Miami to focus on the design, or do you think it's okay when a fashion house, say, gets involved and throws its clout behind a designer?
You know, in this case, I think it's great, actually, because, you know, obviously if you're a fashion house, you have funds. And so they kind of gave Cristina this kind of carte blanche to do whatever it was that she wanted. And so in some ways, you're kind of investing in someone to let them kind of be free to explore, which is really what high design is all about.
Well, let's see what Cristina has to say. This is Cristina Celestino, the designer of the VIP room for Fendi, speaking to Megan Billings.
Fendi asked me to develop a special collection for a VIP room, and so space for a special client of Fendi. And then this furniture will move to Fendi boutique worldwide for the VIP room.
It's such a beautiful collection, and what's really amazing is how soft but yet strong it really is. So the colors are soft, but the materials are very strong, and you've developed some new materials as well. So can you talk to me about some of the pieces? The mirrors in particular are quite special, and some of the fur that you've used and the gold as well.
I work in a spontaneous way with my own design language, and Fendi give me freedom to use all the material and also my own design language. So I use the fur in an unusual way, and other kind of material, for example, marble, brass, and leather, very thin for the lamps. And I develop a new material called etere. It's fur under resin. It's a hard and durable material that entrapped the fur, and fur maintains its smoothness. Is a way to make the Fendi fur more iconic and timeless.
Yeah, there's something very modern about the collection, but yet feels kind of old as well. The vanity feels like it could be in a woman's bedroom, you know, in the 30s or something. So how do you kind of get that balance of modern yet timeless?
Is my way to work. I'm a collector of Italian design, especially from 50s to 80s. And so I love a lot of Italian architect, such as Gio Ponti or Carlo Scarpa. The reference for the color palette was the Villa Planchard by Gio Ponti in Caracas. I love the way he works with different Italian materials, for example, marble, and ceramics of Gambone, and he mixes everything in a modern way, also for the 50s. And I look for vintage style, but then I give a modern touch and a contemporary touch to everything, I hope.
So this collection is meant to just be in the Fendi stores, but people are coming here, and already since I've been here, I've been asking to buy some of these pieces. So did that surprise you? Do you think Fendi might put this into production?
Also, for Fendi, for me, is a good surprise. And they will take a decision about what to do.
Cristina Celestino there, the designer of the VIP room for Fendi at Design Miami. Just a few short weeks ago, Megan Billings, I'm delighted to say, is still with us. So where are you taking us next? We're about halfway through the very fleeting visit that you took. You've already probably had a couple of beachside cocktails and hung out for a little while perusing the papers. Very lax schedule that we run here at Monocle. But who else did you catch up with and what else caught your eye?
Yeah, aside from fun in the sun, I met with Mark Benda from Friedman Benda, and this is another really young designer who we talked about, Misha Khan. So Misha is working out of Brooklyn. He went to RISD. He's about 27, I believe, and he's really pushing the boundaries. The stuff that he's making is, in particular, he made this cabinet that was kind of made of trash, and this item was one of the most popular at the fair. It was quite surprising to me at first glance. It were things like hair and bones and all of this collected from South Africa and then brought back and made in his studio.
So interesting. I mean, it's very hard to draw on trends and it's almost impossible to get people to make a prediction for the future, if you will. But tell me, did you see a kind of very luxe outing? Obviously, these are collectible items, but, you know, that signals to me a sort of return to the idea of tactility, to, you know, thinking very carefully about where these things come from, maybe a slightly artistic statement. Before we listen to the interview, you know, did you notice a particular trend in any direction?
I would say that it, to me, still appeared unusual. You know, a lot of the other things we saw were pretty minimal and clean. But what was interesting about this and what Mark's take on it was that Misha was really kind of taking something ordinary and taking craft and, as you said, kind of art and turning it into something that is a collectible item and so giving it new meaning. So maybe it is starting a trend. Maybe he's on the cusp of that. I'm not really sure.
So speaking of turning something ordinary into something extraordinary, we're about to hear your undoubtedly extraordinary interview. This is Mark Benda speaking to Megan Billings. Mark Benda is from the Friedman Benda Gallery in New York.
So in particular of the pieces that you're showing here, this cabinet that we're standing in front of is getting a lot of attention. So can you tell me a bit about Misha Khan, the designer, and working with him?
He's a designer who sort of straddles the boundaries between sculpture, between craft, and the sort of pure discipline of design. A lot of his works are handmade, usually either in his studio or in a collaborative effort. And this cabinet we're standing in front of is perhaps almost 8 feet tall. It's composed of what he calls his dumpster diving efforts in South Africa. It's made in Swaziland with a cooperative that weaves and beads normally materials. And he sort of finds the weavers there that he can collaborate the best and that sort of understand his vision the most. He's been there a couple times now and he keeps going back to the same places and established his relationship with these weavers. This is probably the most spectacular result yet. The shell was actually made in Brooklyn and then shipped to South Africa and then everything was woven around it with his collaboration and his presence also. And yeah, it's the first time he's showing a work from this series.
These pieces of his, I heard, sold almost immediately when the show opened. And it's, to me, kind of miraculous. There's bones in this. There's an electrical plug. There's pieces of glass. It's made of a lot of things that people throw away. So what is it about something like this that really makes people talk and attracts them?
Well, there's for sure the scale and exactly what you're describing. There's nothing valuable about it at first glance. The value in it is just this massive chef d'oeuvre, this masterpiece that has such a massive presence and commands such a massive presence. There's constantly people photographing it and taking selfies in front of it because it provides such a stark contrast, his work, to normally what's perceived as high design. And for us as a gallery, that's the fun in it, to foster such a young talent that actually does make design that also straddles this high-low idea of what's valuable design. I mean, Misha is just a fearless person, a fearless little child in a way that if given the opportunity will just go completely crazy, and that's what we wanted to channel here. We wanted to show, actually our booth, not sure you had a chance to walk around, is a two-part booth. Our working title was Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but also asymmetrical symmetries in that we're showing different generations of designers and different approaches to design and different approaches to what's creating value in making design. And he's decidedly the youngest proponent and the most radical in the sense that he creates things out of trash and lets them have a presence sort of akin to outsider art or vagabond art that you would find on the road somewhere in the southwest. I don't know if you've ever traveled, all of a sudden you find a cave full of wondrous things of that people would over the decades just assemble, but this was made in the space of a couple of months, of course. It's just this commanding presence and this sort of almost innate presence. It almost seems to have a soul, and that's what makes, I think, that's what makes people take notice.
Mark Bender there of Friedman Bender in New York, speaking to Monocle's very own Megan Billings. Thank you very much, Megan.
Few people have their finger on the pulse of the design world quite as firmly as Katie Tregeddon, editor of the biannual design magazine, Fiera. She joined Josh in the studio for a roundup of some of the best design publications out there at the moment.
Katie, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
You say you're very well, but I've actually heard tell of a... you've just landed. You've just landed from Tokyo.
I have just got back from Tokyo, so I'm... yes, when I say I'm very well, slightly jet-lagged and absolutely exhausted.
But not at all jaded with the world of design, so we're optimistic. And you've very kindly, as has become a regular feature, stolen from our sister show, The Stack. You've brought in your own little stack of design-minded magazines for us to have a little bit of a leaf through. What have you got for us?
I have. Well, the first one I'd love to talk about is MacGuffin, because MacGuffin won the Best Independent Magazine in the Stack Awards the day before yesterday. So I think it's really nice that Design Magazine has won that accolade to start with. It's a fantastic magazine, and it sort of illustrates a trend that runs through a couple of the other magazines I've brought in to show you.
Okay, then fork it over. You're hoarding them all over there.
That's my secret one that I haven't got with me. Imaginary MacGuffin.
Okay, but maybe we can hear a few words about it. What do you think captured the panel's imagination, and what's good about it?
It's really interesting. The last time we recorded this show, I brought in a magazine called Objectified, which had one single designed and made object attached to the front, and then each page was a double page spread where an artist had responded to that object.
Was it a two-pronged fork?
It was. No, it was a plastic knife, fork and spoon.
Okay, my apologies.
Yeah, it was more mundane than that even. But MacGuffin is interesting because it's a craft and design magazine, but it takes, again, one object as the MacGuffin to lead you through the story of the magazine. And in this case, it's rope. So every single article, image, everything in the whole magazine has been inspired by rope in some way, or weaving, or thread.
So it all ties together.
It all ties together.
Why do you think it's interesting to focus on a single item? I suppose in my mind that might be a sort of remedy to the way that online media, particularly when it covers design, is obsessed with novelty. It's obsessed with, maybe you get the first pictures of the new design museum opening, you pass some very short comment, and you move on to the next thing. Is there some great indulgence that print deals with well, do you think, about
absolutely
about lingering?
And I think that's exactly what's going on. So one of the other magazines I've bought with me is Dirty Furniture, which, as we know, will have six issues and six issues only, and each one deals with one area. So they've done one on sofas. This particular one is on the toilet.
I can see that. Rather fetching kind of pistachio-hued toilet on the front. There's something a little bit, sordid is the wrong word, but there's something a little bit kind of base about it, isn't there?
Yes, and cue lots of slightly childish jokes and swearing.
So let me have a little look-see. So you've mentioned this magazine before, but what is it about these six issues? I know you like the idea of the built-in obsolescence.
Like the idea of the built-in obsolescence. And interestingly, I ran a sort of State of the Nation panel event recently about independent publishing, and we had quite a heated debate about what constitutes a magazine. And some people from the more traditional world of magazine publishing were arguing that if there's only six, it's a series of books, it's not a magazine. But I think that's quite interesting, is that the independent magazine world at the moment is really experimenting with form and what constitutes a magazine. To answer your question, I'm really interested in this idea of themes. And I think what print magazines are doing very well is providing a sort of counterbalance to the sort of superficial level at which a lot of online content deals with design. And there's a lot of magazines. I've bought in another magazine which is entirely about the typeface Helvetica.
Is that arriving somewhat late to a Gary Hustwit-hosted party?
Perhaps, yes.
I mean, he famously made a film about Helvetica, all told through the proponents of it, Massimo Vignelli, and people like that who famously used it on the New York subway system. Just to finish off Dirty Furniture, for people who do delve into the covers, there's a rather fascinating looking article here about, it's called In Praise of Privacy, and it's about architecture and the Japanese toilet, which is something that definitely fascinates people around the world, the idea that the Toto washlet can become the toilet of choice in the 21st century. But, you know, by looking at it, it's very clear that they go a little deeper into it in the sense of ritual, if one was to call visiting the loo such a thing.
Yeah.
And the idea of the architecture around it, you know, the textures used and what place that forms in society. You're right, that's a fascinating thing that people don't really meditate on, perhaps, in the endless cycle of trade fairs and new products.
And I think that's really interesting, that these magazines are really restricting the theme and the subject that they cover. So, I mean, the case of MacGuffin, rope seems like a fairly limited subject, but actually that enables them to explore in incredible depth. And I think that's something that's really interesting that's going on in the independent magazine and publishing world at the moment, is that sort of counterbalance to online coverage, which is very quick and very visual and potentially quite superficial. And I'm not using that word critically, but it sort of skates the surface of what's going on. And I think what's interesting about a lot of these magazines is they're able to go into a lot more depth and almost use these subjects as a leaping off point into that kind of depth and analysis of what's going on in the design world more broadly.
Well, I think when examined properly, an editorial theme allows you to unfold and unfurl different things around that very base object and to tell very different stories. So in many ways, it's an editorial tool, right? It's a way of thinking about things. So I pulled you back, I lassoed you backwards in discussions of rope and dirty furniture. But tell me about this Helvetica magazine. Why is this not Gary Hustwit come lately?
Well, this is interesting. This magazine is actually the brand documentary magazine, and each issue picks a different brand and goes into great depth with that magazine. So they've done Star Wars, they've done New Balance, and this particular issue is about Helvetica. And I think it's quite interesting because a lot of independent magazines really shy away from the commercial world of brands. And they make very clear that these brands have had no influence in whether or not they're chosen. This is not something that's a sort of glorified advert. And they're 35 issues in, so this is a very well-established magazine. But it's just quite interesting, again, to go into something in that much depth. And, of course, they do mention the film.
Katie Tregeddon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Alex Funnell, and Megan Billings for her reporting from Design Miami. If you've got any comments or queries, then feel free to email me at hrs@monocle.com. Remember, we're back next week at the same time, and you can always listen again or delve into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud and iTunes. And if you're on iTunes, please leave us a review. It really helps people find the show. We'll be back at the same time next week, but in the meantime, don't forget to check out our sister show on design. It takes a few minutes each week to provide an insight into a person, theme, or object changing and challenging the design world today. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Rees Sheridan. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.